Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now it's time for the Friday Gathering, and this week I'm joined in the studio by Timmy Dooley, TD, who's Minister of State with special responsibility for fishing and the marine, Sinead Gibney, Social Democrats TD and spokesperson for enterprise, tourism, employment, arts, media, communications, culture and sport and defence. That's quite a long list, Sinead. Tabitha Monaghan is here, political reporter with the Irish Independent, and Ellen Coyne, political correspondent with the Irish Times, and you're all very welcome. Thank you for coming in. We're going to start with what happened in City West in Dublin, because we had multiple nights of rioting this week. 16 people we know have been charged in connection with the disturbances at the iPass Centre in Saggart in County Dublin. And Timmy, you might have heard, we've heard plenty of voices on this over the last few days, but we had the spokesperson for the Ukrainians in Ireland speaking on Morning Ireland, Anatoly Primakov, saying that the government is failing to control the narrative around immigrants. Is he right on that one, do you think?
Well, I would disagree slightly. It's a challenge for sure to address the concerns of everybody in relation to migration. I think the general public understood very well the obvious need of the Ukrainian community, because they could see war and bombs raining down on cities across Ukraine back in the early part of 2022. As a result of that, or as a result of some disruption on international borders, we saw a very significant increase in those seeking international protection here. It went from about 3,000 to about 15,000 per year. And I think where there doesn't seem to be the an obvious reason for that, for sure there are communities who don't fully understand why so many have found their way to Ireland in that period of time. So the differentiation between Ukrainians on the one hand and those seeking international protection on the other probably hasn't been as well explained. But what Jim O'Callaghan has been doing, and predecessors, is identifying that we have a rules-based system for those who wish to come here and seek international protection based on international rules and guidelines. And the Minister and the Department are working really hard to ensure that that now moves more quickly. We had a situation where people were left in limbo for far too long before there was a determination.
For years.
And then there was an appeals process. And it wasn't fair. It wasn't fair to communities. It wasn't fair to the people who in the first instance sought asylum. Because if we're to have a solid system, those who deserve or who need international protection need all the services around that. And they don't certainly need to be in an IPAS centre for years. And then the system also then has to reflect. And for those that don't pass the test and aren't considered to be deserving of asylum, they also need to leave. And you know, that's a difficult one, because you don't want to give succor to those who have a racist bent in their ideology. But it is important that any system is seen to be fair and balanced. And if it's to be fair and balanced, it must provide help and assistance to those that need it. But for those that don't, who are here as economic migrants, and look, I recognise that some people come, they take a chance, and they're economic migrants. Plenty of Irish people did that too. So, you know,
that points the way to a solution? If people see that there is a firm but fair system, that then solves the problem in some way?
Look, There's no obvious solution to the problem other than that you have a rules-based system. You will always have challenges to that, and you will always have people for their own ideological perspective will try to exploit those that have a different skin colour, come from a different nation. But as a government that is very committed to an international rules-based approach to those seeking asylum and assisting those, and we have to maybe broaden the debate to understand why people like that come here, why there isn't opportunities in their own country, why the levels of corruption that are there are, more importantly, something that we may talk about later in this programme, how climate change is impacting on those that leave sub-Saharan Africa, where they have no capacity to provide for themselves. Okay. That is based on the activity are the way in which we have managed the environment from a European perspective.
Now, I want to bring Sinead in on this. Around messaging, you know, if that message goes out, well, we have a firm system here, but it's a fair system. Does that change, do you think, how people perceive it? And will it go some way to address the anger and frustration that we see spilling out onto the streets?
I have a real issue with how the government have framed this whole area, and particularly since Jim O'Callaghan has taken over as Minister for Justice. justice, because I appreciate the tagline, which is firmer but fairer, or whatever they put in their programme for government. But I'm seeing all of the firm and none of the fair, if I'm honest. And for me, that negative framing positions international protection and migration as an issue, as a problem to be solved. And that, I believe, is what fuels or contributes to the anti-immigrant sentiment that we're seeing rise in many, many countries, and then which is exploited by bad actors in society. So for me, of course, there is a rules-based system. The government sets those rules. It chooses to adopt rules in certain ways. And I believe that the measures that have all been highlighted by this government, that have been foregrounded by it, and the policy choices they have made are all measures which speak to the firm and not to the fair. So we've seen things like additional countries added to the safe countries list. We've seen deportations, essentially, and in some moments I would describe it as triumphalist messaging around deportations. And all of these measures, for me, we all accept that there has to be a rules-based system, that deportations are a feature of that. But if all you're doing as a government is talking about those elements of it, you are essentially seeding this perception of people in the international protection system as people who are trying to scam the country, as people who are chancing their arm.
So what's missing then from that picture?
I want to hear about the human stories. I want to hear about the very difficult circumstances in which people find themselves. And I want to hear more about the fair elements of our system. A trauma-informed approach, a victim-centred approach. I want to see things like much, much stronger vulnerability assessments, better gender-based care, wraparound supports for people who come in here from the LGBT community. Those safe country lists, for example, when do countries come off that safe country list? Because the safe country lists are important. Absolutely, we need to assess where people are coming from, and as a result of that, decide who needs our help the most. But what we don't say, for example, is that a country might be deemed overall as safe, but it's not for a particular group, like women or LGBTQ plus people. So for me, it is about the humanity and dignity.
OK, so when you see the government becoming more firm around international protection, you're saying that raises suspicion amongst everybody around these people who are coming here looking for asylum.
I think the government influences public thinking on these issues, and government policy shapes public thinking on these issues. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, I do believe that it contributes to people's perceptions of everyone chancing their arm coming to our country because they want to take advantage of systems. And that is not the case. It takes a huge amount of suffering and ordeal for anybody to choose to put their child into a dinghy and send them across the Mediterranean, or for people to uproot their lives from where they are and try and rebuild them in another country where they don't speak the language. And that's not coming through in government messaging, and it's not coming through in government policy making.
No, I'd reject that. I think we provide a very fair system, and certainly my interaction with people who have sought asylum, who are seeking asylum, and who are successful, I meet them in my constituency office almost on a weekly basis, and I meet those two that have been rejected. And I think they feel that they have been well treated by the Irish state, and they're here looking for help and assistance, and I think they feel treated. But we also have a duty to ensure for those that are, and I don't want to use the word genuine, but those who meet the standard to achieve status. We have a duty to them that we put in place, that we have the appropriate resources in place, and then that those that unfortunately don't meet that standard, that they must go. Now, there's also an issue when you talk about what the messaging that sends out. There's another message that has to be sent out in relation to the fairness of it and the firmness of it, is to detract and dissuade those who might be coming, that are coming just from an economic perspective rather than those who would ultimately get asylum. And we have seen a considerable fall off as a result of the firmness that's in place. So there's a message that has to go to the wider, because unfortunately many of these people are trafficked here. They pay very considerable amounts of money to get here in the first instance. And what's particularly upsetting, I think, for all of us would be that they have scrabbled together, their families have scrabbled together whatever they have in their own country, and now it's lost because they don't meet the standard or the burden of achieving asylum. And that's why the Minister has been clear that there would be financial support to assist people to go back to their country of origin.
Well, let's hear from Tabitha and Ellen on this now. Just going back to what we saw this week at City West, do you think that we're starting to feel some sort of an inevitability around that now, that we almost expect this to happen?
Yeah, that's definitely what I was feeling this week, that, you know, there is, in general, not just City West, but there is an incident and it becomes a lightning rod. And then as a result, we do, like you said, this inevitability that there's people who are unhappy, that they will protest, and that I think there's a few issues here and how to deal with it. Yes, I think Timmy's right in that there has to be an explanation that there are those people who don't feel that the system is fair or is firm, and that needs to be explained to them. But then similarly, yes, also we need to tell people that I think there needs to be a general conversation about whether or not we have fully embraced multiculturalism here, and whether or not, you know, in schools, for example, or in sports clubs around the country, that have schools fully lent into that and explaining that there are different cultures, that that people come from different countries, and this is their experience or that experience. And Sinead, you touched on that earlier on, saying, you know, not just about the firm side of things, but also explaining what people's experiences are, and that there is sensitivities there, and people have come from very, very difficult and challenging backgrounds, and that's why they are in Ireland now. But I think those two things are right. But if we don't also tackle what is going on in social media, because we know that a lot of what is going on and a lot of how things were organised around City West came from social media, if we don't combat that, and you know, we've heard the Taoiseach, for example, describe the social media as the Wild West, if we can't regulate that fully and control this misinformation and these narratives that are going out on social media, that it doesn't matter if we're if the government are telling people that it's a firm and fair-based system, and it doesn't matter if the schools are saying that, you know, we need to encourage multiculturalism and we can talk about that and embrace people's differences, if social media is still an issue.
Yeah, again, though, social media proved to be a really valuable source of information for the Gardaí this week, and we heard that officially. Ellen, I know you covered similar events in Coolock and at the Crown Paints site. What did you learn from your work there?
So I think a common theme that has emerged is a bit of a communications chasm, where whenever there is an incident like this, whether it's what happened in City West, what happened in Coolock, well-meaning politicians can come out and say something like, this is not Coolock, this is not Saggart. But the fact of the matter is that it is an element of that community, that anti-immigration sentiment exists and communities are not homogenous blocks. I know where I live, like, there's women in my estate who are constantly collecting toys and presents for children in direct provision. There are also people in my estate who have recently put up tricolours around the local shop as an indicator of anti-immigrant sentiment. And I think the mistake when people make is sometimes politicians can go and talk to quote-unquote the community, but they're not actually talking to protesters, they're only talking to the people that they disagree with. And the greatest mistake I think that we specifically make in Irish politics is, of course, when people express an anti-immigration sentiment, they are often aligning themselves with people who are further on the right of the political spectrum. But I do not think it is true or correct that anti-immigration politics falls on a binary left-right divide in this country.
Has that changed, do you think?
No, I actually don't think so, because when I was looking at some of the women who were involved in organising some of the demonstrations at Crown Paints, which ended up being public order offences, they were women who had stickers on their social media profiles calling for a repeal, or they had signed some of the petitions for the Repeal the Seal campaign that the Social Democrats were involved in, to do with the records of the mother and baby homes. Those are not in any way traditional right-wing positions. And I think that inevitably, when there is a public order incident, as Tabitha said, which now feels inevitable, these people become frustrated because they feel that the political system is not listening to them, and they are now being represented by people that they also don't agree with, who are further to the extreme and who resort to violence. So the group of people who are unheard is growing exponentially, and that's the point in time when politicians on the margins and the extremes start to look more reasonable, if you feel that maybe the centrist politicians that you've been voting for all along are not listening to you on this issue.
I see you nodding, Sinead. Do you agree with that those people don't feel represented?
I think Ellen's right that, you know, we need to listen to people. I guess what I've been saying, though, is I think that, you know, and absolutely Ellen's right that it is a spectrum, but the difficulty is that if we as political leaders don't balance our commentary effectively, if we don't say things on a very evidence-based fashion, and that is my issue, is that the government, I don't believe, is treading that line at the moment. But if they don't do that, what you see is that centre ground is pulled towards the right. And I think, I mean, touching on the online piece is really, really important, because as you said, Claire, the police used that information, and Gardaí Síochána used that information, but that's because they were organising online. You know, there were actors organising online, and they do organise online. And I think that brings us right back to the age-old argument of platforms as publishers, because you cannot allow people to organise and incite hatred in the real world online and not be held to account for it. So that's going to be a focus of my attention over the course of this term, is really looking at online regulation, because actually the regulation exists. The enforcement is not being done by this government.
Mm-hmm. OK, listen, let's move on, because we also talked about local property tax on this programme again, and people are still getting those letters where they're asked to update their property valuation submitted to the Revenue Commissioners by the 7th of November, and then that will determine what your property tax rate is for 26 to 2030. And Timmy, we were talking about this on the show yesterday, and lots of people got in touch. They're really angry about it. They're really upset about it. They just feel the timing is off, given that we have cost of living pressures, and particularly in, when it comes to grocery and energy, they're under huge financial pressure. Do you think it's the right time to make a change?
Well, look, there's never a good time to increase taxes, but it's done now on a 5-year cycle, so it's due and it has to be done. But the government have taken decisions in terms of widening the band. So I think when people will ultimately see what they have to pay, based will not be based on the increase in the value of their home over the past 5 years. I think property values have probably gone up about 25% in that period of time.
And people will say 35%.
Some of them will see a relatively small. So I was just looking at some of the statistics. There's a belief that about 93% of homeowners will remain within their present valuation band. So they'll see an increase, and that's for houses below 525,000 in value. They'll see an increase of between 5 and 25 euros per year. So that's up to 50 cent per week of an increase that, you know, 93% will. Now, there are obviously some homeowners that have more valuable properties and they'll pay a little bit more. But the idea here is to widen the bands to take account of that. But there will be, I think it's only going to collect about 45 million extra in new money. So that's a relatively small amount. But I've also recognised that.
Do you think it's enough?
Well, we'll have to wait and see when the evaluations are done and when all the stats are carried.
But in general, do you think the property tax brings in enough money?
Sure, you never have enough money coming into the state coffers. This is money that's coming in to local authorities to allow them to deliver services.
I know that, but just
Barra
Rowntree made the point that it brought in 500 million when it came in 2013. Now it's going to bring in around 600 million. So it's not really keeping up.
No, it's
and
not.
It should be more.
No. We also then, you have to set that against a backdrop of the other very considerable financial pressures which people are bearing at the minute. You've identified the cost of living, and you've seen the continued high level of electricity and some foodstuffs continuing to rise, notwithstanding that our general inflation is back at 2%. So I think there's never a good time to do it. And I think if you start moving dates that are already set down in stone, it becomes more difficult. At what point do you do it? So it's to try to do it in a way that will put the least burden on homes and individuals. And there is that capacity, as you know, to defer payments for people
who are paying. Yeah, but you pay interest on that.
You do on the portion of it you don't pay, but it helps people who are in really difficult circumstances, maybe from a short-term perspective. And then there are those that are exempt, particularly where homes are, you know, built for the purpose of somebody who has a long-term disability or for people who are in nursing homes, etc., and are not coming back to
Tabitha,
their home.
Do you see why this is a bitter pill for some people to swallow, even though Timmy says that there are few people really who will be paying very high additional amounts? He thinks 93%, but what, 50 cent a week? Is that what you said?
Up to 50 cent a week, between a 5 and 25 euros per year.
Right, people don't like it though, Tabitha.
Yeah, and I think it's a really emotive issue, and I understand why. And I think it comes down to, at the moment, because the local property tax is determining somebody's home as an asset. And that's not how we view our homes in Ireland ever. You know, we have such an association with property and owning our own property and being able to keep it and stay there. And I think the problem is that because it's so emotive, people don't, and you're being told, you know, your property price has gone up by 35%. A lot of people aren't realising that because they don't plan on selling their home. They're not going to say, okay, yes, I bought it in the 80s or the 90s and now I'm going to sell it for X amount more than I bought it for. They don't plan on leaving it. So that's, I think that I totally understand why people are reacting like this. I think as well, it does come down to the timing of this. And we're talking about cost of living. Groceries have gone up. We're coming into winter now. People are going to be turning on their heating. The prices are gone up. We don't have those one-off cost of living measures. And I think a lot of the conversation during the budget and when the budget was announced was this squeezed middle, and how the middle feel even more squeezed after this budget. And now they have to resubmit their valuation for the property tax. And some people will see that increase. And again, it just feels the squeezed middle are being squeezed even more now.
Well, maybe, Ellen, if the reviews and the updated valuations were done every 2 years, it might help in terms of the amount of money it's bringing in, but also we'd be more used to doing this and it wouldn't come as such a shock in every 5 years.
But I don't know if maybe the political courage would be there to do that. Like, I know despite the fact that you're getting loads of texts about this week, we're getting lots of letters into the newspaper about it. In 2021 and again this year, the government did take measures to widen the band to make sure that people weren't paying as much as they were expected to. And as Tabitha said, you know, if you're lucky enough to have been able to buy a house in this country in the current climate, the value of your house starts to feel like monopoly money, because as soon as you're in, you get these letters in the door from local estate agents telling you what other similar properties have sold for. And I know from looking at those myself, we wouldn't be able to afford our current home if it was at the price that it is now when we bought in 2021. Mm-hmm. So that's why people feel that this is bitter and unfair.
But you're the point is, you're not going to sell your house and you're not going to move
Home. Yeah, exactly. It's made up money. But I think the fact of the matter is, I think as Bara made the point very eloquently on your show this week, we only raise 0.5% of tax revenue from the local property tax. And we do need to, if you're not increasing the revenue that you get from the local property tax, I think you made quite a compelling point that that tax has to be raised elsewhere. And is it less fair if the tax measures imposed means that the cost of new homes being built goes up? So it's harder for people to get on the property ladder rather than focusing on existing property supply. But even though it's very unpopular with people, I think people forget that the government, I think, doesn't have the courage to raise local property tax in a very significant way every 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Is that right, Timmy?
I think the challenge, by comparison to other countries have much higher property tax, as you know, but they don't pay the transactional tax on the purchase of their home. So the challenge is there. If you're still paying your mortgage, you're paying off a chunk of tax that was levied on you when you purchased your home, and now you're paying another piece of tax. So that's why our property tax will always lag what's in other countries, because they maybe get into the property market a little bit more cheaply or a bit more easy, and then they're paying that recurring tax in perpetuity. Whereas for us, the level is considerably lower than...
Well, maybe there should be a rebalance, because it's very tough on people who are going in as first-time buyers to pay what they have to pay too. And maybe if it was stretched out over the long term and with a higher property tax, that might make more sense.
I expressed that view a long time ago, but it would be challenging to implement it, because you'd be drawing a line under properties that are already built and then changing the structure from a particular point forward. Okay. Anyway, that decision wasn't
taken. Sinead, you think property... I know you're in favour of property tax, aren't you? The Social Democrats are. Do you think it should be higher?
I think, as Ellen said, like, I think the political courage has not been there to run it in the way that I suppose we probably would have run it. I think those reviews should have been done more frequently. They have been kicked to touch, essentially. And I think the reason it is bad timing now is because the government hasn't dealt with it for so long. And also, as people have referenced already, the incredible cost of living difficulties that people are facing in general. But I want to touch on one thing around kind of home ownership, because I absolutely see the difficulty in being asset rich and cash poor, being a first time buyer and having an asset that now, as you see it, gives you a liability every year in local property tax. But I also think it's really important to talk about home ownership now as an increasingly hard to reach privilege. Because, I mean, I did a review recently for a book in the Irish Times about the London housing crisis. And by the end of it, I think I felt more firmly than ever that I was so fortunate to just simply be in the circumstances that I was in to be able to buy a home. I bought mine in 2009. And my property, you know, has benefited from increased house prices. And at the same time, somebody else who's a mirror image of me in terms of circumstances wasn't able to just get that foot on the property ladder and has now sunk hundreds of thousands into rent over that time. So yes, it is difficult for people, but I do feel we have to recognise that increasingly there are fewer and fewer people who own their own homes, and there are more and more people who are going to be chasing that rental issue for life, and we have such a poor rental sector
in
this
country.
Where is
the wrong here? I mean, how have we ended up in a situation where having a roof over your head that you own is a privilege that you now have to turn around and pay for because somebody else doesn't have it?
I think it's poor government policy that has got us to this place, because, I mean, the fact that generations below my age essentially have been largely frozen out of home ownership because of that poor government policy is something that we have to increasingly deal with the political courage that we're hearing about this morning. Mm.
But still, you're saying that you would like to see the re-evaluation of the revaluation of properties done more regularly every 2 years. So you agree with that notion that property homeowners should pay for the privilege?
It's not, I mean, I'm talking about the privilege of home ownership because I want people to understand, like one of your texters yesterday texted in and said, I've worked hard all my life and I've paid for my property, you know, my mortgage, and I've worked hard to own it. And I fully recognise that. But like just that comparison I've just made, there's somebody who, like me, has worked just as hard. Like I was a single mum in 2009, couldn't get my foot on the property ladder, and my dad had to go in on the mortgage with me, not just as guarantor, but because of what I would call a misogynist policy in the banks, he had to go in on the mortgage with me. Now, there was another Sinead with another daughter who's a single mum who didn't have their dad in that same position. And that family have since then paid hundreds of thousands into rent. And they are not going to see anything in terms of legacy. They're not in a position to move up the property ladder. And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about privilege of home ownership. I'm not saying then that you have to penalise people for it. But what I do think is that property tax is a progressive tax. And as we heard from the economists yesterday, if it doesn't come from there, it has to come from elsewhere. So a properly run local property tax regime is something that we absolutely do believe in. And then it's something that has to go back to the services in those local communities to allow for people then to enjoy it as a community, mm-hmm. regardless of whether or not you're a homeowner or a renter.
Is that what we're saying then, Timmy? That if you are a property owner, you pay for that privilege?
I don't think it's about necessarily paying for a privilege. In other countries, they levy school taxes in certain areas based on considered the average wealth in areas. I think it's about a recognition that to own a home is wealth. It's wealth that you have. It's a struggle for some people, for sure. But it's not for everybody. Some people are doing well. They can afford to pay that tax. It's about giving some connection between your community as well, feeling that the tax that you pay in that area is going back into the services, whether it be footpaths, whether it be lighting, whether it be... Now, there has been a little bit of disconnect in some local authority areas where they haven't been as good at sort of being demonstrative as to where the money gets spent. And like we've seen over the last number of years where there is that wriggle room for local authorities that can reduce or they can increase above the standard level. They can go down 15% or increase 15%. People, by and large, there's a very, very high threshold of payment here. I think it's 97%
Well, the revenue collected, so that's probably why. Sinead, do you want to come back in there?
And it's just, I suppose, around more about kind of speaking to the economics of it, because we do need that stable tax base. And I think, I mean, obviously we are continually dependent on foreign direct investment and tax coming from a smaller and smaller number of corporations. And what we actually need is stability in our tax base. So that's what we espouse as the Social Democrats, is that stability in progressive tax. And that's exactly what this should be.
I just wanted to touch on the Stormy Owen review. We were told we would all have to prepare, wouldn't we, to be without power services for 72 hours. So to be braced and ready. Do you want to kick us off on this one, Tabitha? I mean, what do you think that says about our storm readiness heading into the winter?
Yeah, there was a few things that I thought jumped out at me reading the reports of the report anyway, was that yes, that there is going to be something like what the winter ready plan is. So people are going to be told how to be prepared for 72 hours without, you know, essential services and that. But it was giving fire brigades and ambulance services backup satellite communication systems so that if their systems go down, that they have something to be able to communicate with. I thought it was extraordinary that the services don't have that already. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that seemed like an obvious one to me that they would have. I think there's some obvious things there as well, having the community support centres more formalised as well. But also that what the report said was that people, you know, that agencies, state agencies need to be clearer in their communication because people were confused about who to contact as well. So there was a few things.
Well, listen, believe it or not, our time is up. Thank you all for coming in. Sinead Gibney, Timmy Dooley, Ellen Coyne and Tabitha Monaghan. That brings us to the end of the programme and the end of the week. Thank you very much for listening. You can catch up on anything you missed on the RT Radio app. The programme was produced today by John Byrne, research by Emma Cawley. Our broadcast coordinators, Mary Elizabeth Bruton and Liam Mullen, was on sound. There'll be election coverage, results coverage on RT Radio 1 all day tomorrow. So do enjoy. But for now, it's over to Neil Doherty.